Welcome to the Terrible Podcast with your hosts from thehammerspeaks.com, David Todd, and from SteelersDepot.com, Dave Bryan. Just two Daves talking all the Steelers football you could ever want. And now, here's Dave and Dave.
Welcome to the Terrible Podcast with Dave and Dave. He's Dave Bryan of SteelersDepot.com, the most comprehensive Steelers site on the internet. And I'm David Todd from ESPN Pittsburgh. Dave, it's bye week. And, you know, we talk a lot about when the schedule comes out, about when the right time to have the bye is. And there's really no right time. It depends on your situation. Ideally, I think you'd like to have it come in the middle of the schedule, 8 weeks in, 9 weeks in. That's probably ideal, or maybe some fans think that even later, because you get more banged up as the season goes on, and it's hard to argue with that. This year, maybe the Steelers are a little bit fortuitous, or it's a little fortuitous that it comes early in the schedule because of the situation coming into the season with guys coming off the PUP list and not being fully ready, and then having a few injuries early in the season, the Steelers coming off a loss and two West Coast trips. It is time, not only for the team maybe, but for the fan base, to take a big deep breath, a collective step back, reevaluate what's going on, and hopefully get healthy here coming into next week's game at home at Heinz Field against the Philadelphia Eagles.
That's a good point, good talking point to open up with, because every year when the schedule's announced and we get the firm dates of when the bye week is, it's funny to listen to all the talk that goes along with, oh, man, we got screwed by the bye week this year. Why can't the Steelers ever get a late bye week? Or when they do, then people said, oh, that's too late. We're going to need a early breather, you know, in a bye week. You just never know with these things and injuries and synergy and how a team's playing, how this thing's going to work out. So, you know, the luck of the draw is the luck of the draw there. And they are a banged-up team right now as far as still trying to get Troy Polamalu and James Harrison back, along with, you know, some other bumps and bruises, that have cropped up along the way. But, I'm with you here. It's a good time to have a bye week, considering – two games out west already, both losses, and looking at the health of the roster right now.
Yep, and let's look at the health of the roster. There was a limited practice in terms of, I guess, a lot of guys didn't practice actively yesterday. There'll be a practice today, and then the Steelers will be off until Monday. But my understanding, Dave, is that Mendenhall and Stevenson Sylvester, who have been practicing fully for the past week, practiced fully, and Troy and James Harrison practiced at some level, depending on how you want to classify it.
Yeah, I saw some video on the Steelers Live at 4 yesterday. It looked like James had some pads on and was moving around and doing his drills that way. Now, of course, they weren't having the hitting and all like that, but he was out there moving around. He tweeted later in the day that he practiced fully. Now, we don't know what practice fully is, not being there and seeing what's happening. But yesterday's not the key day with James Harrison. Today's the key day with James Harrison. Yeah, he worked yesterday. If that knee doesn't swell today or feels better today, and if he's able to go today, if we end up getting word that he went fully today, whatever fully is, that's going to be a great sign moving on into this bye week and then returning from it to practice. Now, if he doesn't go today, that's not good news at all, because that means he can't go a day or two with work without getting some sort of swelling on that knee. So today might very well determine what happens with James Harrison over the next 6 weeks or so, if you ask me. Troy Polamalu on that calf injury, by all the sounds and reports that we're hearing and seeing, it looks like he's going to be a go, excuse me, after the bye week. The same with Rashard Mendenhall, the same with Stevenson Sylvester. My best guess right now, based on all the information out there, is those three will be good to go. Now, we don't know about Marcus Gilbert, who kind of strained that groin. Looked like he also had some sort of a lower shin or type injury in that game as well, too. Will Allen, I think, had a stinger in that game and, you know, other bumps and bruises there, but they've got some time to heal those. But, today is a very, very, very key day for James Harrison, for sure.
Let me throw this at you, Dave. If Troy was able to fully go yesterday, Tuesday, are we looking back and say, boy, should they have risked? This is all speculation. There's no right or wrong answer, obviously. But does it make you question whether he should have possibly gone on Sunday?
No, I didn't see him with the kind of the upper shells on in that video yesterday as well either. So I think they're easing him back in. Him practicing, we don't know. We never heard fully or limited or whatnot with him. Of course, the Steelers don't have to release an injury report of the status of him right now. No, I do not question that call at all. Look, Troy, you know, Troy has shown before that he needs time to get over some of these things, and I don't think he's going to put himself back on the field to play if he's not, you know, what he deems an acceptable level either. So I'm not ready to question that decision for him not to play in that game against the Raiders. And look, I'm not sure how much of a difference he really makes in that game. Overall, I mean, Ryan Mundy did not have a good game against the Raiders. You know, one of those touchdowns was a rub off. The other touchdown was a tight end, nice fake block and kind of getting lost over there in the middle. I'm not even sure Troy covers that. So, Troy will play when Troy's healthy enough to play.
And then we covered the rest of the guys, Dave. So we understand the schedule is, as we said, off starting tomorrow until Monday. They'll practice Monday to be off Tuesday. We'll have the Mike Tomlin press conference in preparation for the Eagles and a further injury update, and then a regular practice week going into the 1 o'clock game at Heinz Field next Sunday against Philadelphia. All right, so we've had a chance to test this game against the Raiders a little bit more. Later in the show, we'll talk a little bit about what happened on Monday night and some of the other games, but let's just kind of wrap things up for what we've seen. And you and I had a chance to briefly talk about it on Monday, but we really went through the analytics of the play-by-play. I think one of the things that surprised me most, and we'll start with the defense here, is we've seen some comments about the Steelers being predictable. This is nothing new. Dick LeBeau's been there a long time. The schemes they run are schemes that everybody has now seen. It's the unpredictability has to come on when you're play calling certain schemes. They did show a couple new wrinkles so far this year with the big nickel playing it the way they did, and then playing the penny situation, which isn't particularly new. But Dave, I guess what stuck out for me is the snaps, and the Steelers really went with the same 12 personnel the majority of the game, depending on whether they were playing the nickel or not the nickel and alternating the outside linebackers. And I guess I'm really pointing to the fact that neither Cameron Hayward or Steve McClendon, you know, got more than a handful of snaps. And I just find it surprising. And with the team that's not necessarily setting the edge that well and stopping the running game, nor getting pressure at the quarterback, I'm just surprised they haven't rotated these guys a little bit more.
Yeah, and that's a good starting point. I mean, both of us, I think, going into this game here, expected Steve McClendon to play more. I don't understand why he's not. When you look at some of the raw stats, now keep this in mind. We only have three games worth of snaps to go on. Casey has tripled Steve McClendon in snaps, but both the run and pass numbers per play with Steve McClendon and in the game and Casey Hampton not in the play are significantly different, lower. Now, down in distance has a lot to do with that. Situations have a lot to do with that. But the fact is, that's the fact. And with Hayward, I'm surprised that he hasn't gotten more snaps, at least rotated in. I think that's an area where teams have caught the Steelers in some of this no huddle stuff, especially in the second half against the Raiders. I would like to see more McClendon on the field, more Cameron Hayward on the field going forward. The reasoning, I can't tell you why. Now, as far as the predictability, where has everybody been? It's no secret what the Steelers run as a defensive scheme. This is a scheme that is predicated off of pressuring the quarterback on passing downs through either one of the outside linebackers, sometimes both of the outside linebackers, because one will drop at times. Your inside linebacker, whether it be a Fire X, whether it be a zone type blitz or whatnot, you know, none of that stuff's changed. As far as your coverage goes, you're normally going to see a lot of zone where you're going to allow the receiver up underneath, and Dick LeBeau preaches tackling the catch afterwards. This defense is predicated on pressure. It's predicated on tackling the catch. It's predicated on not giving up the explosive play. I'm not sure why this is all of a sudden a Tuesday or a Wednesday morning quarterback revelation. Ryan Clark said as much. You've got to execute on some of this stuff, and they're not executing on some of this stuff. They're not getting home on these blitzes, for starters. The pressure on the right side with Jason Worlds and Chris Carter has just not been there. The push up front, I thought, has been okay. Nothing to write home about, but I think people are doing their job there. Let's face it, Casey Hampton's not going to have six sacks by the end of the season, nor is Ziggy Hood. It's a push a pocket type situation here. Now the outside linebacker drop play on Chris Carter on Jason Worlds has not been acceptable execution. Chris Carter got lucky early in the game with a pass defense by him, just basically the ball conking him in the back of the head on one. And Jason Worlds was flat out awful. And David, I invite you when you get into the All 22 today to look at the couple of the passes that Jason Worlds is supposed to be in coverage on at the angles that he takes to the football. Just absolutely awful. One of them was a conversion, I think, to Marcel Reese in the second half. One other point of emphasis on this defensive side of the ball: down and distance. I think the defense at certain times did a poor job of recognizing down and distance. One play that stuck out in particular to me was the late third down in, I don't know, 3 and 4. I think it went to Derek Hagan on the left side over there, just a curl out to the side. Ike Taylor's 7 yards off of the line of scrimmage, and that's an easy pitch and catch. Now, I'm going to wrap all of this up into a ball, and I'm going to toss it over to the Raiders' side of the offense here. Carson Palmer did a fantastic job of checking out of plays into other plays and getting the Steelers to show their hand on defense pre-snap. The play in particular that really a lot of people, I broke down the play, the long 60-something yard touchdown by Darren McFadden. Go back and watch everything leading up to the snap of that ball, where the Steelers tip their hand, and then Carson Palmer checks to that running play there. So sometimes Carson Palmer's a smart quarterback, and smart quarterbacks, as we said on the Monday show, I'm rambling here, but on the Monday show, smart quarterbacks, if given time and not pressured, are going to be patient and pick the Steelers up underneath there, and that's what happened in the second half of this game on Sunday.
Yeah, it goes back to when I think about the things the Steelers defense have done and situations where they've been picked apart and situations where they've been effective. If somebody's going to play that West Coast offense and New England plays a variation of it with primarily Welker, but now they have the tight ends that can go vertical, and Hernandez provided a lot of that. It's difficult to defend. And the way when the Steelers got torn apart in that Sunday or Monday night game a couple of years ago, they couldn't defend either side of it. And they were getting killed in the seams by the tight ends, and they were getting killed underneath. So I think what we've seen LeBeau do the next time they played him was the press coverage. And as you said, Dave, that's predicated on getting pressure too, because if you're going to play that press coverage, you really need guys coming in the face. And the problem with the Steelers here is they seem to be somewhere in between. The hurries were more than I expected. I guess they were listed as 9 hurries, and I couldn't find the official game stats or I don't know where they have that on in the NFL stats, Dave, if you can point me to it. But the number that I saw from Mark Cabali, I think, was 9, with Kiesel and Larry Foote each having 3. Of course, the Steelers had 1 sack, so that's kind of 10 plays in the percentage of times Carson Palmer dropped back. I think he that probably puts you at about 30, just under 30% of the time of kind of making him step up a little bit. And the Steelers seem to be in and out of press coverage and not in both times, and very rarely had the safeties down in the box, or both never had both safeties down in the box as far as I remember. So I was just, it is that, Dave, as you say, it's a bend but don't break defense, and predicate on getting not giving up big plays and getting pressure. And if you're not getting the pressure, and you know you're going to play late, you're going to lay off in coverage, and teams are going to come at you in the underneath passing game, yeah, they're going to get beat. And you know it's kind of the same song and dance we've sang for the past year. It's very simple. Of if you don't get the pressure and you're going to give up the underneath stuff, teams are going to be able to drive the ball. And when it's short third downs, they're going to convert them, and that's what's happened. And they're not getting turnovers. And so, you know, I don't know what more to say than that. This isn't anything we haven't seen before. We've seen this over the last 3 years. We just we're used to seeing more pressure, and there are just weeks when it just doesn't happen. So I guess a lot of people want to point to Troy and James Harrison, and that's a very fair thing to do. The only thing, and I tweeted about this morning, is let's not just keep saying that the two defensive players of the year are out. James Harrison was the defensive player of the year in 2008. So he's 4 years older. He's now had some injuries that he didn't have at that point in time. We don't really know the player he's going to be when he comes back. Do I assume he's going to be better than Chris Carter or Jason Worlds? Of course. Of course. If he's healthy, I have no doubt about it. But we don't know what level his health is, and we don't know how quickly he'll perform at what would be 100% for him, if ever. So that's caveat number one. And caveat number two is, look, Troy's had this calf strain, and it's apparent that he had this going into the Denver game, and maybe it got exacerbated, maybe it didn't. But 2.5 weeks off is probably, as I said from the very beginning, if you strain or pull a muscle, it's at least a two-week thing. He'll be 3 weeks when he starts preparing for the Eagles. So he's had plenty of time off, and if that comes back, Troy makes a difference on this defense. And if he plays like the Troy that we know, there was an article, an insider article on ESPN yesterday talking about the dramatic defense Troy makes because of basically the term they used was something similar to splash plays, but they tried to quantify it more directly. And so that's a big impact. And no question, if these guys come back almost overnight, these problems could be solved. But they're not the guys from 2008 and 2010, so the question is, if they aren't, are the problems going to be solved?
James Harrison, I'm not convinced he's going to be. I think he'll be more technically sound than Carter and Worlds as far as the drops go and getting in the right position when asked to drop into coverage. I think that's going to be an upgrade there. As far as pressure goes, I'm worried about that. I don't think James Harrison is going to be the same player that he was over the last several years. Now, of course, last year it was the lower back and the orbital fracture. In fact, the orbital fracture helped his back get better by having the time off there. The back evidently is not the problem. The problem now, of course, is the knees. So if he does get back on the field, I worry about how long those knees are going to hold up because let's face it, he is a power rusher when he's at his best, bull rushing. Any increase over what they've been getting is going to be golden. At the very worst, I guess it stays maybe the same, but I think they pick up where, you know, his ability to drop and know where to be on the field in certain instances. Troy gives you an extreme wild card situation because this is a guy that is studies film good enough to make quarterback. We saw the cat and mouse game of him and Peyton Manning in that first game. When he does things like that, it confuses a quarterback. If it confuses a quarterback like Peyton Manning, what's it going to do to a quarterback like Mike Vick or Jake Locker or some of these other guys that are not premier quarterbacks that the Steelers are going to face this year? So, and plus too, you know, Troy does gamble a bit more in the secondary. It does cost him sometimes, but it does come up, produce some splash plays on top of it. But make no mistake, you know, people say, well, Dick LeBeau doesn't adjust. Hey, my family tree, as far as I know, does not trace back to the Dick LeBeau family tree. But this scheme is no secret here of what's going on. When you read things on NFL.com or Post-Gazette and all like that, predictable, yeah. But, I mean, it's the execution that goes along with it on top of it. People are saying, hey, how about more press coverage, man-to-man? If you're not getting that pressure on that quarterback and you're playing man-to-man, a team is going to drop a few explosive plays on you. In a game, I don't care, because you cannot give a quarterback that much time, and for a cornerback to cover a guy. So I think the Steelers, I posted my talk stats this morning, David, up-to-date talk stats. The Steelers have done well with explosive plays, only averaging two over the first three games. Unfortunately, two of those six have gone for touchdowns, which is kind of uncharacteristic for the Steelers there. If you remove those two explosive play for touchdowns, unfortunately you can't do that. But if you remove those from those games, we might very well be talking about a 3-0 Pittsburgh Steelers team right now. It's hard to quantify that, especially when they happen in these games, but it is an important nonetheless. Now, the turnovers have not been there, and that's not going to be there if you don't get pressure. So all of this circles back to getting pressure on the quarterback, regardless of the personnel that you have in there. And for people that are ready to jump off the bridge because of the scheme right now, I just, a couple more games, I might be, getting my number to get in line. But I think they can perform better moving forward, and I'm not ready to say that Dick LeBeau's too old and the scheme is dried up.
Yeah, I'm with you on all of that, and I'm just, just to get it, think about it in a way that is relative. There's a on cold hard football facts, the defensive hog index that they use. It's the negative pass play percentage. It's a very simple thing to think about, and when you think about negative pass play percentage, it's the percent of dropbacks, which obviously is attempts. I assume they include quarterback runs in there that weren't designed, quarterback scrambles and sacks. That's how you determine your dropbacks. And then it's the the number of plays where you get a sack or an interception. And with the Steelers having five sacks and two interceptions and having played three games where the quarterbacks have thrown, just in a very, very rough terms, 100 passes or probably have 110, 115 dropbacks, you're running at less than 5%. And every Super Bowl champion in the past 5 years since 2007 has been over 10%. When the Steelers won it in 2008, they were first in the league at 12%. Every other team has been in the top six, and four of the five teams have been in the top three. So, and all of them over 10%. So it's a simple, again, we look for things to try to not make things too complicated. And Dave's talk stat where you got explosive plays and turnovers, that's a simple one, and it's a great thing. And this is more of a season-long formula of looking at things, but it's very telling, and you want to see those numbers certainly increase.
And another thing that I like to track too, David, and this comes from that the hidden game of football book is that adjusted net yards per passing attempt differential that I keep as well too every week.
Yep.
There's people that say, oh boy, you can't put sabermetrics on football and all like that. I call BS on that. I really think you can quantify a lot of these things as far as success and failure with teams over the long haul of the season. Now, I warn people with any of these stats that through week four, you have to wait through about week four, week five for some of these to start taking shape, for the numbers to start being in volume, to start quantifying things. And, mostly when you look at this net yards differential stat, it takes in a lot of things that you just said there. It takes in your attempts, your completions, your yards, your touchdowns, your sacks allowed, and interceptions on both sides of the football, okay? And then you come up with an adjusted number for both the offense and the defense, and then you find a differential of the two. And basically, your offense adjusted net yards per passing attempt better be higher than your defense, regardless of what either side of the number is, greater or less. And if you're in the positive area in this differential come later in the season, you have got a fantastic shot at making the playoffs. Plain and simple. Now, going on from there, we've seen some teams finish, you know, lower that have actually won the Super Bowl with a, you know, that didn't finish the top of the charts in differential. But I'm talking about teams, monitoring teams that at least make the playoffs. Now, the Steelers right now, in that adjusted net yards per passing attempt differential number, are ranked 13th overall. They actually cracked the positive differential number this past week. They've got a .48 differential. That's a move in the right direction, even though at 1-2, because last week they were 21. Once again, it's hard to quantify this, though, because we're only three games into the season, and, of course, this number's not going to move at all during the bye week right now. But as long as you have an offense led by Ben Roethlisberger and him able to do the things that he does with the passing game, the Steelers are going to be in a lot of football games this year, assuming they don't give up the big plays. And I think that kind of ties into the talk stat. If they're able to get some turnovers, able to not give up the big play, just based on the quarterback that they're going to play this year, I think they're going to be an above 500 team, and I think they're going to compete for the playoffs. Now, of course, the divisional games is going to play a huge, huge role in what happens this season. But, you know, kind of watch this number going forward here, too. And, with the differential and you know, just kind of watch that as compared to other teams and how those other teams are doing as well.
Yeah, Dave, one of the things that I talked with Kerry Byrne of Real Hard Cold Hard Football Facts about last week is how Ben in his rookie year, he was averaging around 9 yards per attempt and really big numbers that, you know, a lot of people in the conversation, he's like, a lot of people look at Ben and say he managed the game and the Steelers won in spite of him. And he said, that's not really the truth. Ben was incredibly efficient throwing the ball down the field. And the Steelers are down a little bit on that number this year. It's 6.61. They're right in the middle of the pack in the NFL. The leaders are Carolina at 8 and Cincinnati at 8. The Giants, you know, Carolina's 8.7, Cincinnati's 8.0, Giants at 7.8. This it's hard to be critical of the offense here. They have been so effective. Do you feel like the scheme that Todd Haley's running here with the receivers, do you feel like there's a good mix of going for the deep ball, going for the middle, mid-level routes, and then the dump-offs? Do you think that's working out as hoped so far?
Absolutely. I think it's been fine so far. You know, Ben talked about this, I believe, yesterday, saying that, they have as many in the playbook for Mike Wallace there as far as deep balls go. Just teams have done a good job of defending that and trying to take it away, which has led to more of your underneath type stuff. Now, Ben missed. I can't wait to look at the All-22 today on that play on Mike Wallace down the left sideline there, where I think Ben actually missed Wallace for a big gainer there. But the big plays have been there for them, and I do like the mix of the intermediate passing game so far on top of it. And when you look at, hey, the Steelers have 12 explosive passing plays so far this season, and that ranks them, you know, up in the top third of the league in that area. Now, of course, they don't have any rushing explosive plays to go along with that. But, you know, when you go back and look at the Green Bay Packers, their Super Bowl season, the Green Bay Packers ran the ball absolutely horrible during that Super Bowl season. So as long as you're running well.
So did the Giants last year. They were terrible.
Yeah, as long as you're able to run in situations like 3rd-and-1 or 3rd-and-2 and 4th-and-1, which the Packers were able to do that season, and you know, the Steelers seem to be able to do that so far this season in those areas, it's been proven that you don't have to run more for more than 3.6 yards per carry to make it to the Super Bowl here. So it's just, you know, sometimes when you look at how good Ben Roethlisberger has been in play action through the first three games, they're running the ball enough badly early on in games to set up play action for what it's worth. So they do need to get better in the running game. I'm not trying to just flip that off of that's not important here, but As long as you're able to run in key situations and run when you're supposed to be able to run, I think they're going to be able to get away with it. We'll see how Rashard Menendez helps when he comes back, hopefully after the bye week. But, you know, there had been a lot of holes for Isaac Redmond and Jonathan Dwyer so far. And you know, Menendez doesn't hit the hole as hard, you know, as fast anyway either. So we'll have to see how that goes. But I don't think you have to necessarily have a 100-yard-a-game rushing attack to win in the NFL.
No, of course you don't. That's, yeah, as you said, that's been proven. All right, Dave. Anything else from the in terms of personnel or schemes in the game on the offensive side? We didn't touch on too much, but again, not a lot of snaps for Jericho Cotchery. Heath Miller's obviously a big part of the offense. He was split wide a few times. We saw all the backs kind of get opportunity, and I think it's as much the coaching staff trying to find the right guy and see if it created anything different for them, giving everybody a shot. Jonathan Dwyer not back on the field after he fumbled. So that's, he got a little bit, he didn't get a big shot so far this year, but he's gotten some shot. And with Menendez coming back, that may mean that he loses his opportunity, because Batch looks like he might be a third down guy, and you probably see Redmond in that role a little bit. Rainey brings a whole different dimension. And if Menendez eventually assumes that starter's mantle again, that could spell maybe even not getting a helmet for Jonathan Dwyer at some point down the road.
Yeah, absolutely, because Batch is your better third down back of you know, outside of Menendez right now. So I don't think that and Todd Haley said last week that when Menendez comes back, they're gonna be smart with him. So you know, you're not gonna see 20 carries a game for Menendez. You're gonna see a mix of some of these backs here. Redmond's obviously the guy that they look to is kind of more of a power runner inside, so you have to think he's going to be active. So the odd man out here is probably going to be Dwyer, and you're going to probably see him on the inactive list to replace Menendez whenever this happens. I like what Batch brings to this lineup. Especially in third down situations, especially in a no huddle, until Menendez gets up to 100% here. We've seen what he can do in pass protection. He's a smart kid as far as picking that up goes. And I think he runs, a lot of people think he's smaller than what he actually is, and I think we saw some nice runs from him in between the tackles. And if the blocking picks up a little bit, I believe he's your ultimate kind of your new age Mawaldi Moore in this offense. So that's the personnel on offense. Of course, we talked about maybe more use of the 12 personnel whenever Wesley Saunders gets back up into the lineup here, which, by the way, there's starting to be some conflict here when that's going to happen here. I think Wesley posted something, still a couple of weeks to go. In the media, originally I said that he had to wait until after the Eagles game, because I didn't think the bye week counted against a suspension. The media said otherwise and said, hey, no, he just misses four game checks here. Then he tweets something, like I said on game day, saying something about two more weeks to go. So who knows at this point?
Maybe he meant till he gets to play in a game. I think it is over after this week.
Well, let's hope so. Using that 12 personnel, I think gives Todd Haley a chance to be multiple and attack defenses in a different way there, which should help possibly the running game a little bit more here as far as catching defenses where they don't want to be against a certain formation here. But tip of your hat to the Raiders with what they called in that game. I thought Carson Palmer called it, in that no huddle, did a fantastic job with his pre-snap reads in that game. The no hurry or the hurry up type offense really, really caught the Steelers flat-footed again, because let's face it, the first half of that game, the Steelers defense, I thought, did a good job. There were about four or five key plays in that game, man. The special teams has got to do a better job at covering. The Antonio Brown touchdown that was called back was because of those penalties, really hurt. The two fumbles by the offense in this game, the offense played great, but you cannot put the football on the ground, especially in key situations like they did. And that really contributed to the loss as well, too. So when you go back through and you watch this film over again, you see that, as Mike Tomlin likes to say, in all three phases of the game, The Steelers did not perform better in offense than the other two, but they were not perfect in all three phases of the game. And when you do that and you don't have turnovers and you don't have explosive plays, you're going to let teams like the Oakland Raiders hang around, and you run the risk of losing a ball game, which is what happened on Sunday. So, you know, this team is a few plays away from being 3-0, but if pigs had wings or however that saying goes, you know, but –
if pigs could fly,
yeah. if pigs had nuts and candy, it'd be Christmas every flying day, right? I love to hear athletes get cliches mixed up.
I heard one the other day; it made me laugh. So Dave, all right, I think we've killed this one. Let's briefly kill a topic that's been murdered on the airwaves for the last 36 hours. But do you have anything to add about the NFL's stance on this Seattle Green Bay call?
They blew it.
Did blow it here. You know, the thing, I went on the show yesterday and said, you know, once they took it upstairs, it's kind of out of their hands and blah, blah, blah. And then we find out that they told us wrong on television in the game Monday night. And when the NFL released their statement on Tuesday, they said in the end zone, the simultaneous catch is reviewable. Well, I mean, here's the thing. I said, look, they blew this call so badly on the field that it makes everybody change their mind about this type of situation. But then the fact that they went upstairs to a real, not a substitute, a real video review guy, and he gets it wrong, to me, that's just beyond appalling. I mean, it makes it a million times worse than it was, and it was already about as bad as it could be.
Yeah, I mean, it's clear and obvious, A, well, the NFL, I like how they worded their statement, yet that yes, the pass interference was missed on the play, the offensive pass interference, because clearly Tate pushed off there. The second part with the dual possession, that's what was ruled on the field, correct?
Yes, it was ruled simultaneous catch touchdown.
All right, and the simultaneous, reviewable or not?
It is not on the field of play. It is in the end zone, and that was the clarification that first came out about 1:15 yesterday.
Okay, so you know, there's no other way to draw it up than they blew it on this. So
they blew it twice. They blew it on the field, and then they blew it again.
And Phil Luckett, wasn't he the involved? He wasn't the replay official, but he was the rules, you know, the guy that's on the sideline over there, I think. And everybody remembers Phil Luckett from the
coin toss.
Yeah, from the coin toss on Thanksgiving against the Lions there. But, oh, boy, could you imagine if the Steelers had been been on the other side of that one? It sucks to be any team on the side of that one, but hey, you know, it is what it is. People are saying, are trying to back it up and say, hey, Green Bay shouldn't have put themselves in that position. Knock it down. The referees are paid to get these calls right, and they missed this one there. So I don't know how else to put a bow on it there. And maybe this will speed up some negotiations here. But this BS on Twitter, people saying that boycott the NFL. Yeah, good luck with that.
Right.
I'm going to watch.
Yeah. So, okay. So Seattle gets a win. So Dave, here we are. We didn't talk at all about the Patriots. You know, every other storyline got thrown out here. Let's just talk briefly about a couple things around the league. The New England Baltimore game, again, not the most beautifully refereed game. Looks like New England has this one wrapped up. McCourty drops two interceptions. There's another one that Arrington looks like it's going to be a fair catch, and he stumbles over his own feet in the turf. And so Baltimore ends up getting a couple chances. And then Tucker, who's been unbelievable kicking field goals for him, I think in the week before he had three from 48 or longer, sneaks a 27-yarder or so just inside the right upright. That was as close as it could be. And Baltimore starts out 2-1, and the Patriots start out 1-2. Did you see anything in that game that stood out for you?
You know, this New England defense is playing a lot the same way that it did last year. Through three games with them already, 15 explosive plays they have allowed. David, and they have 12 on offense so far. Baltimore had 9 explosive plays in that game on offense against against the Patriots there. So, and if you look back at some of the articles I did last year, heading into that game against New England, it's not surprising that this is the same type of New England defense. They are fine with just trying to outscore you. Period, and they're not concerned about yardage on defense. They'll gamble a lot for some big plays, and that's kind of what I've seen with New England so far. Hey, mark my words, when you got Tom Brady on the field and you've got Gronkowski, now they're going to miss Hernandez for a couple weeks. There's no way that Kellen Winslow, in my opinion, is going to be able to pick up that much slack. One good thing for all you fantasy owners out there is that this is going to force them to have to get the ball to Wes Welker a little.
And they did. And now it really does make you wonder if it was it Bill Belichick's not using Welker as much in the first 2 weeks was strictly
punishment.
Well, it's financial. It's organizationally. We're gonna lower your value. We're not gonna pay you going forward. So we're not gonna use you.
And it's a shame that if it if indeed I'm not ready to go that far with my tinfoil helmet, but I mean Julian Edelman is not Wes Welker.
Okay? Although he played well,
he has played well, but in my opinion, he's not Wes Welker.
The thing I tweeted: if you could have a choice of Julian Edelman on your team, Julian Edelman for $1 million or Wes Welker for 10, you'd probably take Edelman, and you find a good way to use that $9 million.
Yeah, are they? There's some people saying, "Hey, are they doing just enough with Welker to trade him mid-year?" Hey, you got Belichick involved here. That's not totally out of the question.
It happened with Randy Moss in Week 4 a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I'm not. Yeah, I mean they very well could, and especially leading up to a week or two before they get Hernandez back. Hey. I wouldn't put it past them as far as that goes. When you look at New England as far as the adjusted net differential goes and all too, they're almost right at even with their differential. And I don't have my last year's numbers in front of me either, but it seems like they were right on the cusp of that last year for a long part of the season as well too. So, you give up that many explosive plays in a game like that against a Baltimore team that can move the ball down the field, you're going to get what happened the other night.
Yeah, and Baltimore's not bad. It's hard. If you grow up in Pittsburgh, you never root for the Ravens, but I was rooting for Torrey Smith. Happy to see him have a good game. Obviously, a tragic event in his life. Dave, the other things that kind of stood out, and the Detroit game was one of the crazier games in the history of the league, I think. I mean, you score 46 points in the fourth quarter. The Lions get 2 touchdowns in the last 20 seconds with their backup quarterback. And then we have the new overtime rules. And I had Bill Burke of Advanced NFL Stats on yesterday. And we talked about this fourth down situation and what you would have done. I can't believe the way it looked to me that Sean Hill was not expecting that snap. It looked to me, they said they were going to try and pull him offside, but when he put his hands under center, that snap came back. He didn't hesitate for a second. It was a clean snap. They didn't get it. What do you think actually happened there?
I wish I could tell you. There was some sort of miscommunication there, I think.
Do you think the quarterback and the center were thinking they're snapping the ball? I mean, obviously the center was, but, I mean, do you think the quarterback was
– It looked that way to me.
It sure did, man. I hear some guys talking on television that wasn't the case, and I don't buy it. I don't buy it. I think they tried to catch him maybe sleeping, and they didn't get it.
Maybe Sean Hill took it into his own hands there and thought, I don't know. It was pure. Boy, that was a wacky. That catch in that game by Nate Washington.
Oh, playing catch of the year?
Go ahead and ring that one up for an ESPY, right?
Yeah, that's going to be right in the top 5 for player of the year. Pulled it off that guy's back. Anything else jump out? I mean, we we see the Niners lose. Again, parity early in the season here. We have, what, two teams that are 0-3, and it's Cleveland and New Orleans. Cleveland maybe not a big surprise, but New Orleans certainly a surprise. We've got how many undefeated teams do we have? We have two, right?
Two. You got Houston,
Atlanta. Houston, Atlanta.
Three. Houston, Atlanta, and Arizona.
And Arizona, right. Okay, so you got one surprise there and maybe two not so, so surprising. But the whole point is the Steelers at 1-2, obviously you'd rather not be 1-2, but I think if you were charting out your season going in and you're being realistic, you had to think there was a chance they're going to lose at least one of these. They were going to lose one of these first three games. You didn't expect them to lose two. But the good news, the West Coast is out of the way. That's behind them. And they get the bye week here. So, all right, Dave, anything from our listeners or anything else that we can touch on here?
Let's see. We did get kind of an email last week there from our buddy Bob in Canada. He says, well, sometimes I get too opinionated, sometimes mouthy. Let's see here. He's basically kind of a mea culpa after the game against the Jets about Mike Wallace and how he's kind of dedicated here. He admits that he underestimated Peyton Manning in the first game there. I'm not going to read the whole thing here, but I think Bob's off the ledge as far as Mike Wallace went, and that's kind of what we kind of asked everybody to do. Boy, you don't hear anybody right now saying trade Mike Wallace or everybody being upset with Mike Wallace right now. And boy, those hamstrings sure look fine to me, David. Everybody was worried about that heading into this. Look, what Mike Wallace, and we stated this all offseason, it's a business type of thing. As long as Mike Wallace plays when he gets into games there, everything's going to be fine. And boy, how quickly that holdout seems to be behind us. It seems like it happened a year and a half ago right now. But Bob, we appreciate you chiming back in there. It's hard sometimes not to overreact to some things. I think one thing that David and I try to do with this show and what I try to do on Steelers Depot is we try to take a step back from things. We try to give you a very objective type view on these things. We're not afraid to blast people, but we're also not afraid to put Dick LeBeau, we're not going to rush out and put Dick LeBeau with a for sale sign on him out at the curb after three games of a season where the Steelers could easily be 3-0 at this point either. So, there's a fine line there, and I think David would agree with this. Try to look at the big picture. Get on NFL Game Pass. Purchase that. Watch these games again. Watch the All-22. It is amazing the things that you will see when you watch a game more than its original broadcast.
Yep, Dave, good stuff. Let's just a couple programming notes. Dave will be on my show this afternoon around 3:15. We'll talk about some of the personnel groupings. We'll do some more game-focused stuff, a lot of which we did Monday, but maybe a little bit more breakdown. I'm going to get into the offensive line conversation with Dave, and we'll get into some more of that. We will be back Friday. Of course, no game this week, but remember, the Thursday night game is Cleveland-Baltimore, a division game, so you get a look at those two teams, both of whom the Steelers will see twice. Still six division games left on the schedule, so that's going to be a big part of the backloaded situation for the Steelers. After they play that Thursday night game in Tennessee, there'll be five games into the season, and six of the remaining 11 will be in the division. So they're going to be able to take care of their own business if they take care of those six games, that's for sure. Again, thanks for the donations. Keep them coming. We're going to make a new push for that here in a week or two, do our Dave and Dave telethon. And you can hit that on the SteelersDepot.com or on PayPal. You can follow Dave on at Steelers Depot. You can follow me at David M. Todd. And you can follow the site at Terrible Podcast. And I'm up on Facebook. The show is now up on Facebook. So if you go like me on Facebook, I'd appreciate that. It's called David Todd Show on Facebook. So that's new as of last night. A special request, go give it a hit, give it a like, and I'll be posting things there. Make sure you know what guests are coming on and that type of thing as I do on Twitter. So, Dave, anything to add?
12 and I, what are you showing line on the Baltimore?
12 is what I saw this morning.
What do you got?
I'll take the Ravens.
I'll take the Ravens and lay the 12 as well, too. And we appreciate all of our listeners. Great banter on Twitter and email. Don't be afraid to send us an email, theterriblepodcast@gmail.com. David, take us to Friday.
As always, thanks for listening to The Terrible Podcast with Dave and Dave.